Of course, saving Adam and Eve and showing them this much grace doesn't work at all. And so the generations unfold and it gets to a place where God says all of the thoughts of man's heart were only sinful all of the time. And so God figures on the flood as the only solution. Now, don't answer this out loud. I mean, question, ready? What was the emotion and motive and purpose? What was the emotion and energy and meaning for God of the flood? Don't answer out loud. What was he feeling? Why did he send the flood? Because he was... Don't say it. Why did God send the flood? Well, there'd been that 7 generations of sin, and Lamech becomes the 49 people murderer rather than just the 7, rather than just the 1 Cain. And all this evil has spread out all the earth. And so God sent the flood because he was angry at sin. And he figured out that he had to wipe out off the face of the earth all these people and start again. And he saved Noah and his family. Now, where did I get that from? Was God's energy anger? I wonder what it says in the Bible. Do you know what the emotion was? It says it 3 times. Let me tell you. I'm going to read it out to you. Ready? Genesis 6. Where am I? I've jumped past. Yahweh saw how great man's wickedness was on the earth. Had become everything inclination of all of man's thoughts were only evil all of the time. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. And so Yahweh said, I will wipe out mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground and the birds of the air, for I am grieved that I made them. The flood is not the wrath and rage of God, it's the tears of God. We think he's angry because we broke the law. No. Oh yes, of course we are. He broke the law, and God is full of wrath every day, it says in Psalms. But God is heartbroken because we broke faith. We broke his heart. We broke his own children. We pulled down the temple on our own heads. We injected crystal meth into his children while they were babies. The flood. Okay, now we've got to accelerate. There we go. The flood. Then, completely randomly, we get to when the flood's finished, Noah comes out. The text then says, man's heart was still only evil all of the time. So he hadn't cured anything with the flood. They spread out across all the earth, all the nations. And then we hear Abram. And his name is Abram at the start. It becomes Abraham later. And for reasons that are completely not in the text, they're absolutely nowhere, and they're in the mind of God, he calls this one man from over in Samaria, drags him around 1,000 miles to come to a land that he's never seen, and says... paraphrase. Random Joe, I'm going to make 7 promises to you which will determine the destiny of the human race. Here they are. Are you ready? And then the chapter headings of the whole Bible, Genesis 12, verses 1 to 3. And the entire rest of the Bible is the unfolding of Genesis 12, 1 to 3. Here it comes. Yahweh had said to Abram, leave your country, your people and your father's household and go to a land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. So the Bible's going to show how one man, random Joe, becomes a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. You will become a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. This is world history here. I will curse those who curse you. And finally, all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. That's the chapters. That's it. And then God does that with one man. And what we're going to watch here is he does it with one man. And then he does it with his kids and his grandkids and his great-grandkids, who are all feral. And then he does it with the people. And then he changes the name of Israel to call them a nation. And he just keeps unfolding these promises over and over again. Micro, bit bigger, bit bigger, bit bigger, bit bigger, bit bigger. Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. So that is the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. The whole book of Genesis is a compression of the whole Bible. It's a compression of what's going to happen for the rest of the Bible. Interestingly, the book of Matthew is written to directly match the book of Genesis. And it's got phrases pulled out of Genesis all the way, from the opening to the end of Matthew. Delete that thing about Matthew. It's too complicated. I messed it up. Genesis is a compression of the whole Bible. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And at the end, Joseph is stuck in a prison in Egypt, in the wrong country, in the wrong situation, betrayed, lied about, sold by his brothers, rejected. And in the end, he becomes in charge of all Egypt. He gets the vision about the storehouses for food, and he stores food for 7 years so that at the end of the seventh year, when the famine comes, people from every nation eventually come to Joseph for food. And he blesses all the nations of the earth in a little prototype. So the promises to Abraham come true with these guys. But that's only a little picture. God's going to do it again with the people group. And then he's going to do it with the nation. And then we're getting ahead again. Okay. Here we go. They go to Egypt. They live in Egypt for 400 years, 430 years, and then they get oppression under a pharaoh who drives them, makes them work 7 days a week, makes them make bricks without straw. They're oppressed under the king of Egypt, who is a figure of Satan. He wants to wipe out this race, and he eventually works out, I know what I'll do, I'll wipe out every male child that's born, because that will wipe out my enemies here. And guess what? That's Satan's plan. He wants to wipe out the bloodline. So they figured on the plan of wiping out every male child that was born. God says, don't mess with my firstborn son. If you harm my firstborn son, I will kill your firstborn son. Let my firstborn son go. He calls Egypt his firstborn son. God's full of intimate metaphors and imagery all of the time, the whole Old Testament. Pharaoh says, no, sorry, they're not going. And so there are the 10 plagues. Now, you'll recall the 10 plagues. 9 of them are against Egyptian gods. What's the top god in the Egyptian hierarchy? Ra, who is the god of the sun. So he starts off with the gnats and the frogs and the Nile, and Yahweh comes against these Egyptian gods and ticks them off one by one. I can control them, I can control that one, I can defeat that one. He gets to the 9th, the god Ra, the top of the stack in Egypt. And so what does God do to the sun god? I'll just switch the sun off. See how like that? Having defeated the entire echelon of the gods of Egypt, does Pharaoh let him go? No. So Yahweh says, you have robbed me of my firstborn son, I'll rob you of my firstborn son. And he sets up the Passover. And in the Egyptian system, all these gods, the firstborn son in each family is the priest of the family. And so for the 9 days, God wipes out all the gods of Egypt. And on the 10th day, he wipes out the priests of every god. He says, my firstborn son is coming out. The drama continues. Pharaoh gets furious, chases them. They come down against the sea between 2 pagan shrines. The gods of Egypt are on their north. The gods of Egypt are on their south. The sea is here, and the armies of Pharaoh are here. No problem for God. I'll do it between the shrines of your gods. So he takes them out. So then we have the 40 years of wandering in the desert, the year of going and getting the law, the 39 years of punishment, the 40 years, and then they finally come into Canaan and they inherit the land. They conquer everybody there. The rumour that Moses took 40 years to get through the desert because he was a male and refused to look at a map is not true. So they go down 40 years and then into Canaan. It took about 10 years or so to conquer most of Canaan. But then Joshua died and every man did what was right in his own eyes. And so we have the period of the judges. There's cycles of judges. The book of Judges is a terrible book. It's full of gory, perverted, sick people. All of the leaders in Judges are flawed. The people sin and sin and sin again. God raises up a judge, saves them. They sin again. It's like... rah, 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 rah. There are seven major judges, three that do a pretty good job, one that's dodgy, which is Gideon, and then three that are terrible, ending with Samson. And at the end of the book, there's a rape scene. It's just an ugly, ugly book. The book reads like this, and the punchline is at the end of the book, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. And that's what happens on earth when everybody does what they think is right. The people ask for a king. God says, I know they're rejecting me, but I'm going to give them a king. And he gives them the three great kings. The three great kings are... got it. Saul first, then David, then Solomon. And they have so much political victory and power that by the time Solomon is reigning, Solomon never has to fight a war. He rules everything from near Turkey. He rules part of Egypt. He rules Arabia. He's like the global superpower. Vast riches. Now what we see is that God has made the promises to Abraham come true for a man, then for his family, then for his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, and then as the people grow, and then he starts calling them the nation, and he makes all the promises come true. So under Solomon, people are coming from all the way around the world to be blessed by Solomon. Come and listen to his wisdom. He's trading everywhere on earth. And everything that God promised Abraham has come true in physical terms. So he has political fulfillment, geographical fulfillment, space and time. He's wealthy, he's safe, he's secure. All the people in Israel are totally happy under their own vine and fig tree. Super wealth, super power. But our disease at the fall is much, much, much worse than is going to be fixed by all our dreams coming true. And so God has said to Abraham, I'm going to make these seven promises come true for you. First, for the first 800 years or so, I'm going to make them come true physically, politically, geographically, economically. But that's not going to do it. I'm going to have to do this on the inside of you. I'm going to have to do this to the whole cosmos. And so at the peak of Solomon's power, worldly power, we have the telling verse in 1 Kings 11 verse 1, King James Version. But Solomon loved many strange women. Strange meaning foreign. He marries 300 wives from other cultures so he can have political alliances, political power and political security for himself. He sets up shrines for them all. He imports every religion into Jerusalem. And the moment he dies, his sons have a bun fight. The nation is split and never recovers. Because God's not going to make it ever recover. God's not going to make the kingdom come true in geopolitical economic terms anymore. So the next 400 years we see the kingdom fall to pieces. And completely give way to idolatry. Hundreds of years. The northern kingdom, nearly 300 years, worships Baal. They worship Yahweh sometimes. They import some other gods. They mix it all up. They don't worship in Jerusalem anymore. The south, which is Judah and Benjamin, they're pretty bad. 20 or so kings of the north, they all stink. 12 or so main kings of the south. Four of them are kind of like get a 6 out of 10. The rest are lousy. And idolatry eats the soul out of Israel. Now, during the time back in David and Solomon, there's the wisdom literature. Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs, and Job. Now, Job was written before this. It's written in the time of Genesis. But that's assembled, that whole literature, all of the songs of the church, to provide wisdom, to keep us from folly. Short on time, I'm going to keep going. Here we go. But, hey, do we love wisdom? No, we love folly. We always think that the... But what if we did that? That would be more fun, wouldn't it? But if we follow God, we'll be missing out on... So we always turn to folly. It's by human nature. So as the kingdom disintegrates, we ignore the wisdom literature, we know the kings fall apart. God, the kingdom, goes into the hearts of the prophets. And the prophets start preaching and telling of a time when all of the promises of God will come true, not only physically, spiritually, geographically, economically, I've included spiritually there, but spiritually, they'll come through cosmically. The planet will be changed. Human nature will be changed. Their heart of stone will be taken out and put in a heart of flesh. So the prophets are looking forward into the future. They're looking backward at Israel's history and telling the truth about it. And they're looking around at the day and telling people what's actually going on, what they're doing, and to repent. Do we repent? What about if it's a prophet of Yahweh? Do we repent? No, we go into exile. The kingdom, the northern kingdom, dissolves at 720 or so, gets destroyed militarily by Assyria. They get dispersed all over the world. And the southern kingdom holds out for another till 586 BC. And then it's destroyed. 99% of the people are wiped out. Tiny number are taken off to Babylon. Daniel was one of those people. Ezekiel is one of those. And so the land is emptied of nearly everybody. For 70 years, mostly. Jeremiah is the last prophet. He weeps over Jerusalem. He spends his whole ministry completely fruitless. He's the consummation of the prophets. He comes at the very end of his life. He's still in Jerusalem. There's a tiny community left there to farm the land, to keep the land from going completely desolate. And the people come to him and said, "Okay, Jeremiah, you've told us 100 times to do A, and we've done B every time. So tell us what we should do. Should we go? Should we rebel and go to Egypt, or should we stay here under the Babylonians?" He says, "Go to Egypt." And they say, "We know you're being sarcastic, because you know every time you say A, we say B. You're just being sarcastic." He says, "Okay, I agree. I'm being sarcastic." And they swear, we promise that we will do what you told us this time, because everything you've told us is coming true." He says, "Okay, don't go to Egypt. Stay here. If you go to Egypt, you'll die." And so they tie Jeremiah up, they all get together, a couple of assassinations first, and then they all go to Egypt. And they get there, and they lie Jeremiah down, they put him in a tree trunk, and they saw him in half. And then they all die in Egypt. Don't we do that every single day?
I know.
Well, my wife does at least. We all do it. We all do it. It's human nature. We can't help ourselves. God's not finished. He sends a remnant back. He sends with Zerubbabel a group of people, then he sends with Ezra later on the priests, and they reset up the activities of the priest. He sends Nehemiah and they re-establish the walls, and then after that Haggai and so on, Zerubbabel, they rebuild the temple itself. But it's a miserable temple. And when Ezekiel was prophesying this glorious temple that would be rebuilt, the one they rebuild, the really, really old people can remember the other one, and they just weep when they see the foundations laid. This is pathetic. And it's because that's not where the kingdom's going to be. It's not in this physical temple. It's a supernatural temple. The prophets told us it's going to be it's going to be cosmic. There's going to be something so spectacular happen. The people come back. Just kick back a bit. Just before the exile, the bloodline is the issue. Can the serpent kill the seed of the woman? Wicked Queen Athaliah comes to the throne, and she gets all of the messiahs, all of the descendants of David, and kills all of them. Where's the bloodline? She misses a two-year-old. The two-year-old is being hidden in a secret room by a nurse. And Satan thinks he has wiped out Messiah's bloodline on earth. No, Yahweh's in this. This is not going to happen. And so this king is then proclaimed king at age 6. And he turns out to be a lemon. But God keeps the bloodline going until we get to, guess who? Jesus. There he is. Now we're going to skip here. There's 400 years of nothing in the Bible. After the Old Testament prophets, there's just 400 years of nothing. Israel gets conquered by 3 different superpowers. The Pharisees are invented. A whole lot of political developments, but not significant for the Bible narrative, because they're not recorded. Jesus comes. Jesus comes, and all of the promises come true in himself. He is the fulfillment of every promise that God's ever made through a prophet. He's the fulfillment of every promise that God made through Moses. And before that, he's the fulfillment of all the promises to Abraham. He comes teaching, he comes healing, he has power. His word has power, his hands have power. He's the glorious man, he's the true Israelite. He speaks the pure words of God. And finally, we've got our hands on God. And we get what we've wanted all along. We get to nail him up. Now, that's if the story should have stopped a whole lot of times when the bloodline was just about wiped out and so on. But back in the garden, it should have stopped. Why did God keep the story going at all? And then, knowing that we were going to do this to him. And there's no story on earth that works. Every story on earth works on the fear of death being snatched out at the last moment. So the bomb's going to go off. MacGyver has got 14 seconds to work out how to get the electronics and the chemicals and the fluids all to happen at once. 3, 2, 1, and he clips it. And the hero survives death. He's saved from death. Every story works that way except for this one. It didn't work. It's the story that didn't work. The hero is killed. And all of his people flee. And he's buried in the ground. And that's how all stories since the fall turn out. Not God's story. Death could not hold him, because death is not the last word for Yahweh. And so God makes it not the last word for us. And Thomas says, I didn't see it, I don't believe. Jesus says, put your finger in here. And Thomas falls on his knees and worships Jesus and calls him my Lord and my God. And Satan's never going to catch up. And so the church is born on Pentecost. Fire comes from heaven. It's an Old Testament scene from the mountain of Sinai reenacted on the 3,000 people converted at there. Now, as Pentecost happens, Jesus goes into heaven and sends the Spirit, comes as a wind that blows into every place. And that's when the last days begin. Now, we think, well, when the last days are coming, you know, we'll know when the last days are coming. No, biblically, if you read your Bible, the last days are from Pentecost. In these last days, and then he talks about what life is like. And so we're in last days. We're the church, and Satan's going to keep on attacking us until we're done, until he's done. And so that's the era we live in since Pentecost. But God gets to trump everything. He's going to send the gospel to every nation on earth. And he's going to transcend every language barrier, every cultural barrier, every ethnic barrier, all our tribalism, all our love of hating each other. He's just going to swamp it all. And right near the end of the story, he's going to peel back the sky. He's going to have a judgment between the sheep and the goats. He's going to open the book of life, and anyone who's not found there will go to judgment. And then he's going to say something like, let there be light. Because it's the new creation. But it's probably more something like he says in lots of parables, come into the kingdom prepared for you from before the foundation of the world. Come to the wedding banquet. Come, my bride, come away with me. And then we have the C.S. Lewis scene where he says that this was only the first chapter, and every chapter is better than the one before. and we go higher up and further in, and we realize that we were hardly even awake in everything we've ever done, because awake, O sleeper, rise from the dead. And the resurrection will come true, not just for what God's done in our spirits, but our bodies and our minds, and everything in all the creation will be remade and reborn. And so, God will make the story work. Starts with the children. We mess up at every possible place. And he says, I am going to prepare a place for you. And I'm going to get you home, no matter what it costs me. And I'm only going to select certain people. Here's the qualifications. You ready? Random Joe. I'm going to pick people who are not rich or not famous or not intelligent or not wise or nothing at all. I'm going to get every shape and colour. I've got no discretion. Go out into the highways and byways and drag people in. I'm happy with that. I'm not going to work by anything that people honour and respect. I'm going to do it by magic. I'm going to send my word out into all the corners of the earth, and I'm going to gather my people that I've been planning to bring home forever and ever, and we're going to party like nobody's business. And that is how the story ends, beginning happily ever after. So now, go and see how you did. And see which bits you're strong and weak on. And don't take the envelopes home. We're going to use them next week. So put them back in the envelopes. Put the cards back. And we'll stack them back over there. Thank you for coming.